And yeah, if you wanna say any final ideas or thoughts, Althea.
Well, thanks for listening to The Gap. Thanks for taking the time to hang out with us this morning. I hope you have a great weekend. Please don't travel to the coast, even though it's Memorial Day.
Oh, right. Memorial Day. I remember. I didn't remember.
Me either.
What's in the name? Thank you. I appreciate
that. What's holidays? Yeah.
Holiday. Yes. Enjoy yourselves. Kate Brown says stay home. So I'm just going to quote her. Stay home. And I think that's going to about wrap it up. Thank you so much, Althea. I'm Tammy. And thank you, Ty, for your great work engineering. Have a great rest of the day.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. You can also listen to us at K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM and at K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Staying with us, this is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on Sojourner Truth, using COVID-19 as an excuse, the Trump administration has been deporting children without notifying their family members, while at the same time, they're trying to do an end run around the Flores Agreement. The Flores Agreement protects children by limiting the number of days children can be held in detention. It stops children from being held indefinitely. Our guest is Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. And for our weekly Earth Watch, Florida prisons are becoming growing hotspots for COVID-19 in that state. We speak with Rudy Turnstone, a community organizer working for prisoners' rights. And why is Donald Trump after the U.S. Post Office? Scott Klinger, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, breaks it down. Also, our weekly Earth Minute with Ann Peterman. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. We're going to take a very, very short music break, and we'll be right back with Peter Shea. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Under the cover of COVID-19, Donald Trump's administration continues to implement the conservative agenda he promised his base. A key strategy of Trump's re-election campaign is to give up attacks, We wish he would give them up, to keep up attacks against migrants and refugees. He has given a huge contract to the Fisher Sand and Gravel Company, a North Dakota construction firm, to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Having signed several contracts with this firm in the past, Trump has also diverted government funds from other pressing needs to go towards his wall. And only two migrants have been allowed to pursue requests for humanitarian protection at the U.S. southern border since late March. And new data reveals that an estimated 900 unaccompanied migrant children have been turned away at the border since March, this according to ProPublica. Furthermore, since COVID-19 broke out, the Trump administration has deported hundreds of migrant children alone. And in some cases, without even bothering to notify their parents or other family members, this according to the New York Times. At least two children deported in recent weeks have been tracked down by international refugee agencies after their relatives in the United States asked for help. Among those two children is a 16-year-old Honduran girl who fled her homeland after being sexually assaulted. This ProPublica also reported on that. Now, many of the migrant children who have been quietly and quickly deported were denied the opportunity to speak to a social worker or to apply for asylum due to violence and other conditions in their home countries. And also on Tuesday, May 19th, the Trump administration announced that it will be indefinitely extending the order that allows the Trump administration to release migrant children from detention without notifying their relatives, forcing them to stay in crowded and unsanitary detention centers when they are forced to go back across the border to Mexico, or to be returned if they're from other parts of Central America, to be returned to Honduras and Guatemala, where they have to face situations that they have fled from. I'd like to welcome our guest, Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. The focus of his work includes technical support on constitutional rights of migrants, refugees, and children, class action litigation of issues with broad impact on indigent, minority, and ethnic communities, and so much more. Peter Shea, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
There were two clips I actually wanted to play about migrant families in detention refused to separate from their children, because this is tied into, I know, a case that's very, very close to your heart, which is the Flores Agreement and the Trump administration trying to find an end run around Flores. This is a clip from NBC News.
Parents in ICE detention facilities are refusing to be separated from their children. Officers presented parents with the option of separating from their kids or remaining together in detention indefinitely, and not one of the 366 families agreed to separate. NBC News Justice Correspondent Julia Ainslie joins me now. And Julia, first, why is the administration giving parents this option right now?
Well, Allison, they explained to us, I talked to a senior ICE official who said this is in response to a lawsuit. Now, the lawsuit was brought on behalf of families in detention because the lawyers are making the case that these children shouldn't be kept in there on what is an average of 6 months during the coronavirus pandemic. Instead, they think they should be released and monitored with their parents. Now, instead, what the government decided to do was offer this form to the parents to say, look, you can release your children, but you can't go with them, to then go show the judge that these parents are choosing to keep their children in detention. So the lawyers say this isn't at all what they intended with the lawsuit. And they say that these parents were completely caught by surprise. And a lot of them were very disturbed and very intimidated that the U.S. government was going to take their children away, because, of course, that is what happened in the summer of 2018.
Oh, such a scary situation. Julia, ICE is drafting a new form that would ask parents to waive their rights under the Flores settlement. Can you explain what all that means?
Yeah, let me explain that. So the Flores settlement goes back decades and basically protects the rights of immigrant children in ICE custody. And what it really says is that they shouldn't be there longer than 20 days. Now, these families have been there for an average of 6 months because the U.S. government has tightened asylum to the point that there are really no other options for these people. So they're waiting to see if they can appeal and go through a long legal process, while the government is waiting to see if any of these barriers can be removed so that they can just deport them as a family. In the process, the judge who oversees this Flores settlement that protects their rights says that these families have to, the government is not in compliance because of the families. So now what ICE is going to do and what they told us exclusively is that they are working on a new form that would ask the parents to waive the rights that are granted to them by the courts, which would include keeping their children for under 20 days, which obviously is not happening. So it's just another dead end for a lot of these families that are trying to seek asylum here and have some kind of protection for their health, for their families.
Our Camila Montoya Galvez reports that due to a Trump administration health order citing the coronavirus, border officials have been expelling thousands of unauthorized migrants. Hundreds are unaccompanied minors. And Camilo joins me now. He is a CBS News immigration reporter. Camilo, thanks very much for being with us. You write that unaccompanied children are being expelled by border officials. What does that mean? Where do they go?
Sure. So under U.S. law, Elaine, unaccompanied migrant children who arrive at the southern border without their parents or legal guardians are generally supposed to be transferred to the U.S. Refugee Agency. However, in March, the Trump administration issued a public health order directing officials to expel most migrants who don't have proper documents to enter the country under the rationale that they could spread the coronavirus inside immigration jails and overwhelm public health resources at the border. So now these kids, just like adults and other families, are being expelled to their home countries or to Mexico.
Well, Camilo, before the pandemic, were children refused entry?
No, like I said before, under U.S. law, these children are supposed to be transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where they are housed in shelters, provided with legal counsel, child advocates, and where they can go through regular immigration proceedings, seek humanitarian protections like asylum, and hopefully be reunited with a family member here in the U.S. or to a sponsor. So this is a seismic shift in U.S. immigration policy.
And Camilo, you obtained government data that shows the impact of this directive. What more can you tell us?
Sure. We learned through the statistics we obtained from the U.S. Refugee Agency that only 58 unaccompanied migrant minors were sent to the office in all of April. This is a huge drop from the numbers that the agency is used to on a monthly basis. In March, the agency received nearly 2,000 unaccompanied migrant minors. That dropped to 58 just in April, because most of them, as we now know, are being expelled to their home countries under this public health order.
All righty, there you go, Peter. Shay, welcome. Before we get into this attempted end run around the Flores Agreement, talking about these children, migrant children, who have been quietly and quickly deported while being denied the opportunity to speak to a social worker or apply for asylum due to violence in their home countries. Now, your comments on this, because how legal is this? I mean, what kind of law is Trump using, if any, to justify this? Peter
Shea.
Well,
we think that they're using a part of Title 42 of the United States Code, which generally provides authority to the federal government to take certain steps during medical crises. However, we know from documents that have been released that the White House and Stephen Miller in the White House have had actually been planning for many years, for several years, had been planning to use medical reasons, medical excuses, alleged viruses, in order to shut down the border. So this was really an opportunity for the White House. And what the White House has done several months ago is to commence a policy of having a complete blockade at the border, so that any person who is apprehended, including children, including unaccompanied minors, who is apprehended today along the border, is immediately deported either to Mexico, where with the help of the U.S. government, camps have really been set up. They're really ghettoized camps. We have some reports that they're actually U.S. military that guard these facilities, or they're deported to their home countries promptly. We believe that that violates several fundamental rights, of particularly of the children. Number one, it violates the United Nations protocol relating to the status of refugees, which the United States is a party to. That protocol is an international law and provides the right to apply for asylum in any country. Secondly, it violates a 2008 federal law, commonly called the TVPRA, and that law says that any unaccompanied minor who is apprehended by the federal authorities, by the Border Patrol, or by ICE, is entitled to a full due process deportation hearing, without question, without exception. And unaccompanied children who are currently being apprehended close to the border, in close proximity to the border, in violation of that 2008 law enacted by Congress, are not being given a due process hearing. They're not being able to apply in those hearings for asylum or for refugee status or for what's called special immigrant juvenile status, which children are eligible for if they have been abused, abandoned, or neglected in their home countries. And instead of being allowed to apply for those benefits under federal law, they're simply summarily deported either to Mexico or to their home countries, absolutely regardless of the dangers that they face. So that's the current situation that children are facing along the border.
This, to me, Peter Shea, is a continuation. I mean, not that it should be any shock. I mean, this is the same administration who back in 2017 really, you know, separated even babies and young children, thousands of them, from their families. But the trauma that these children must suffer, you know, and may be with them for a very, very long time, with very, very few resources to help them to mitigate it. To me, this is serious child abuse. And, you know, I read a story that some of these children are awoken in the middle of the night and even lied to and told, well, you have to go to another state so that you could get a hearing, when in fact they are in process of being deported, and children being, you know, landing in Honduras without their families even knowing that they're there, or, you know, having to find their way under really dangerous circumstances. And given the fact that, you know, it is proven that this kind of separation causes trauma to children, not only emotional trauma, but it likely has a physical impact on one's body as well. Peter Shea, your thoughts on this? I mean, what can be done?
Well, I think it is important to also understand that it is not just trauma, it's not just psychological trauma that these children face, it's not just exposure to illness to the extent that they're moved into one of these camps in Mexico or returned to the streets in Guatemala or in Honduras. They actually face death, because many of these children were fleeing rampant gang violence, uncontrolled gang violence, inability to report violence to the police. So we're not just talking about children being summarily deported with no due process whatsoever, with no type of hearing whatsoever, with no consultation with a lawyer whatsoever, with no consultation with their relatives, either in their home country or their relatives living here in the United States. We have to realize a lot of these children have parents living here in the United States, and uncles and aunts and grandparents. But they're not just facing the trauma, they're actually facing death in the countries that they are being removed to summarily. So we're definitely looking into those violations. In addition to litigating actively in the Flores case, we're also looking into the possibility of separate litigation that could be brought on behalf of those children. These children have different and far more protective rights than adults have, precisely because of international treaties and because of federal law enacted by Congress. And all of those are being circumvented by this administration, really just for political gain, to satisfy the base that President Trump is hoping will come out and reelect him for a second term in office.
The thing about it is that the Trump administration has been breaking all kinds of international laws, particularly when it comes to migration, asylum seekers, immigration. But it doesn't seem as though there's much that can be done about that. I mean, the U.S., they've dropped out from the International Criminal Court, and likely for good reason. But we have to keep, because you're absolutely right, these children are facing death. And, you know, as a mom, I really understand also what it means for children to be just snatched away from their families and the damage that that brings. I mean, if they're not killed, you know, when they get back to their homeland, they are still suffering deeply. And the United States, as far as I'm concerned, should be charged, the Trump administration should be charged with child abuse. But speaking of not being separated from their families, it seems now as though the Trump administration is trying to make an end run around the Flores Agreement. And you could, again, briefly just tell us the time limit that Flores says the children could be kept in detention. Tell us about that, because that is really, you know, insidious, because what they're trying to get parents to say, well, I'll release my child to you, right, rather than have the child stay with me. These are families who are in detention. You know what I mean? So, of course, what parent is going to say to the U.S. government, yes, you could take my child, and you have no idea what's going to happen with that child. Tell us about this, and if you think this tactic is going to work, because it's really to undermine and get rid of the Flores Agreement.
Yeah, we also, at the same time as children, unaccompanied children, are now being apprehended at the border and simply summarily deported from the country without regard to their health or their safety. At the same time, there are several hundred children who made it into the United States with some unaccompanied and some accompanied with their parents prior to this border shutdown situation. Those children are detained, and if they're accompanied, they're detained with their parents by ICE. They're detained in three detention centers, two in Texas and one in Pennsylvania. Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, those children, by and large, and their parents have not been released from custody. It is well known that detained populations, incarcerated populations, are far more likely to be exposed to the COVID-19 virus than people who are not detained. Virtually every agency has set up every jail, every prison, U.S. Bureau of Prisons, have set up programs to engage in the release of people who are vulnerable to infection. And however, ICE has done very little in this regard, and particularly with regards to these families who are in custody in these three detention facilities. We recently won a series of court orders in the Flores case, which is pending here in the federal court in Los Angeles. And on March 28th, April 10th, and April 24th, a judge in who oversees compliance with the Flores agreement, that agreement was reached in 1997 between us and the government. And that agreement basically requires that all minors in custody be released promptly from custody, generally within 20 days or less, without unnecessary delay, they're to be released from custody. The administration, rather than releasing these minors, has kept most of these minors, particularly the accompanied minors, in these three detention centers, has ignored the dangers that the COVID-19 virus presents to their health and their safety. The judge on those three occasions ordered the prompt release of these children. The government responded just about a week ago by calling all the parents in for interviews, did not advise the attorneys of record. Pretty much all of these children have attorneys of record. The ICE did not advise their attorneys of record that their clients were being called in to be interviewed. The parents were called in to be interviewed. Attorneys who attempted to be present during those interviews were blocked from being present during those interviews. And during those interviews, parents who did not speak English or Spanish were not provided with interpreters. And parents were suddenly presented by the government with a demand, really, that they promptly, within a matter of minutes, that they promptly make a decision to have their children separated from them or remain with them and be deported. We have interviewed a large number of those, a couple of hundred of those parents, and their descriptions of this, of these brief interviews, are really horrific. They've described how, if they had any questions, the questions were not answered. If they wanted to know, well, what kind of vetting would be done of a sponsor before my child would be released to that sponsor, they were not told how that would be evaluated. They were basically coerced in these short interviews.
Wow.
They were basically coerced to make a decision, and most of them refused to be separated. Probably 95% refused to be separated because at that time they were fearful, they were threatened, they were coerced, and all in an effort to give the appearance that the government was complying with the court's orders, when in fact what the government was really doing was everything that it could to ensure that those children would remain in detention for the following weeks or months without being released to sponsors or close relatives here in the United States. So that's the situation that's unfolding as we speak.
Just outrageous and heartbreaking in so many ways. Peter Shea, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. But for people who want to be in touch with you, your organization, who are concerned about these things, what should they do?
People, we have a large number of people, lawyers, doctors, interpreters, who are volunteering and helping us, because we do have the right to monitor the situation. They should simply go to our website, which is centerforhumanrights.org, and there will be additional information on that website about how they can help in this situation.
Right. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to share this with us. We'll continue to follow this story. I mean, the suffering of these children, their families, just unconscionable. Peter Shea, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mark.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. Coming up, our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. And also, Donald Trump is after the post office. Why? We'll find out more about that. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
That we have each other.
Check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. We have a community calendar there. Also, our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. And we're nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And internationally, I'd like to give a shout out to our listeners in Exeter in the United Kingdom. What we're going to do now is go to our weekly Earth Minute.
The USDA is expected to soon make public a proposal to legalize widespread planting of the first ever genetically engineered tree, an American chestnut, into wild forests, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Forests make life on Earth possible, yet GE Chestnut researchers, supported by a retired Monsanto consultant, are dismissing concerns about the risks and undermining efforts to protect forests from this reckless and irreversible experiment. If this scheme is approved, the real experiment would take place in our forests, and the risks are huge. There are no long-term risk assessments of releasing GE trees into forests, and scientists warn that such assessments are not possible with trees that live hundreds of years. Engineers think they can recreate nature in the lab, but wild American chestnuts, or any species, cannot be restored with GE facsimiles. They are not protecting nature, they are replacing it. Join the effort to keep GE trees out of forests. Go to stopgetrees.org. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, this is Margaret Prescott, and now we're going to go to our weekly Earth Watch. I'd like to welcome Rudy Turnstone, a community organizer working towards prison abolition and decarceration, as a steering committee member of the COVID-19 hotline for incarcerated people, CHIP. Only a month old, the all-volunteer-run hotline has documented almost 200 stories from inside local South Florida jails. Rudy, here's what we're going to do. Just play this very, very short clip from the Miami Herald about inmates at Florida prisons themselves discussing COVID-19 conditions.
To continue that on, like I was saying, one case in Endorm, it would spread and we would have a little Italy. But the thing of it is that the nurses are going to have contact with them in isolation. Then they're going to go and have contact with the elderly people. So it doesn't make any sense for this to happen. I don't know, maybe the governor could take the elderly out of here and save them.
I'm Lana Blair, DC number P51067. I'm housed at FWRC in Ocala, Florida. Precautions being taken here are few and quickly contradicted. Being told to separate is impossible. We have to sleep 12 inches to 21.5 feet from other inmates in a dorm of 86 women that share 12 toilets and 9 showers. We are given 1 4-ounce bottle of maximum security all-in-one soap to last 1 week. No person protection equipment being worn by guards are coming into work from outside to prevent virus coming in. No extra cleaning supplies is being given, and what we are giving are being watered down.
So there you have it, Rudy, and I'm wondering if that is pretty much what you are also hearing. I also know that you're an environmentalist as well, and the conditions inside prisons and jails really toxic. And when one talks about the environment, one generally doesn't think about that, but it is a very, very toxic environment, and I'm sure that that is adding to the crisis and spread of COVID-19 in Florida prisons and jails, Rudy.
Yes, Margaret, absolutely. We can corroborate a lot of what was said in that recording. And prisons are their own ecosystems, and they are a very dangerous ecosystem, as we have come to learn from the information and stories that we've collected from the hotline. They're very dangerous in the ways that social distancing is essentially impossible. And with the stories that we've gotten from Broward County and Palm Beach County, people are sharing cells where they are closer than 6 feet away from each other. They're also in Broward County on a 23-hour lockdown. And so with that lockdown, it's providing not only dangerous environmental conditions for each of the people exposed, but also it's really strenuous on the mental health of people as well, having less time to connect with their family, loved ones, and lawyers, shower, and do whatever they can in about 45 minutes that they have a day. Luckily, because of our efforts and others, it's gone to 22 hours, but that's still not enough. And so, specific to the dangerous conditions that they're exposed to, the reports that we've gotten are at best, 2 small bars of soap, unless you have a week, unless you actually buy soap on commissary. Cleaning of cells once a week. Some people are facing torturous conditions of the air conditioning being turned off to quote unquote prevent the spread of COVID-19. So some people are suffering severe heat exposure, and there is a lot of reckless behavior on behalf of the administration and also the guards. A lot of not changing garbs, going from more contaminated areas with COVID-19 to uncontaminated areas, introducing new people from the streets without properly quarantining them into general population, and overall a very strong lack of attention to safety. And so not only lack of attention, but outright abuse in some instances. We've had reports of at least one person being assaulted by guards and severe medical neglect. I'm very sad to say that we have multiple reports of people that have either had broken arms, broken bones, exposed wounds, or have, with the coronavirus, severe symptoms of throwing up blood and still being not getting medical attention, any. And then the attention that they do get, if anything, is at best Tylenol, maybe a little bit of water, not even enough water to hydrate, maybe getting water twice a day.
Yeah, and you know, also that a lot of prisoners they have found have at least 2 underlying conditions, which also makes them vulnerable. Rudy, we just have a couple of minutes left, but what has been the response? Because the conditions are horrible, and deadly. And it's good to know that you and others you work with are agitating and organizing to do something about it, as I'm sure the prisoners are on the inside, because they tend to be very good at organizing themselves. But what kinds of response have you had from Ron DeSantis, that Republican governor there, and the prison officials generally? Are they responding to what you all are raising?
I can't speak to what Ron DeSantis has said. I can tell you that our reports are out there and available, and they're being denied publicly. But we know that from our protests outside the jails and from our work that at least 5 people have been released. And immediately after 2 different protests, prisoners were provided masks, and there was attempts, even a small attempt, to improve the conditions inside.
Yeah, that's great, because it's encouraging to people to know that whatever the conditions are, however bad they are, that there is something that we can do to say no, and that this is not acceptable, and impact what is going on and make a difference. So, Rudy, thank you. Please continue to keep us posted on the situation there. We know that there are about 8 prisons now in Florida that have become hotspots for the spread of the virus. So a lot of concern there. And we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. Rudy, just very quickly, is there a way for people to contact your organization if they want to do more or find out a bit more?
Yes. We're on Facebook.com. COVID-19 Hotline is where you can find us on Facebook. And we really need donations right now for calls. And you can send us Venmo donations at CHIP Hotline, CHIP-Hotline.
Okay. Rudy Turnson, thank you so very much for all of your work and joining us today. Thank you. All righty. We are going to now wrap up our show with, trying to find the answer to this question. Donald Trump seems to be obsessed with the U.S. Post Office these days, U.S. postal workers, the whole operation. What is going on? I'd like to welcome to our show, welcome to Sojourner Truth, our next guest, who will be breaking all of this down for us. I'd like to welcome Scott Klinger, Senior Equitable Development Specialist at Jobs with Justice and an Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So, Scott, postal workers, essential workers, they're out there in the rain, snow, whatever is going on, generally beloved by people in neighborhoods, appreciate their sacrifice, their efforts out in the hot sun, whatever weather there is. What is Trump's problem with the U.S. Postal Service? What is it he's complaining about, and what is he proposing to do?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what his problem is, but he has been trying to take the Postal Service and create a crisis where one doesn't need to be. The efforts to privatize the Postal Service are not new to Donald Trump. They've been around for 40 years in both Republican and Democratic administrations, and they continue. There's parts of the postal network that we all own and we all have built together as consumers and taxpayers. That would be very beneficial to companies like UPS and FedEx and Amazon and Pitney Bowes and others who would love to have the profitable pieces of the post office. What the president's trying to do seems far deeper and more nefarious in terms of trying to take direct control out of an institution that, as you said, is America's most beloved government agency and has been running quite well for many years and has a long history, a centuries-long history of innovating to meet unmet public needs. And rather than focusing on what those new unmet needs might be and how the post office could generate revenue, the president is instead trying to provoke a crisis, trying to say he should be able to set postage rates and package delivery rates when there's an independent commission that has done that and has made the package business, quite frankly, a very profitable piece of the post office. It's more than covering its costs, more profitable than first-class mail, and it's very competitive, and it's the only real place where people in small towns in rural America can deliver packages, receive and mail packages quickly and efficiently and inexpensively.
Yeah, so one complaint that I've heard is that You're right. The package delivery has a growing source of revenue for the post office, but that they've begun to default on retirement benefits payments, right? And it's being reported that they lack the funds it needs to continue in full operation. Is this actually the case? And then there have been various proposals about what the post office can do to bring in more revenue. One was turning rural post offices into broadband hubs, which would help people in rural areas. Your thoughts on this problem about the funding and the money, and contrast what Trump would like to do with what some other people who may have some more friendly proposals to make around the post office. Scott Klinger.
Yes, there's actually two issues with the financial challenges piece. One is in 2006, Congress passed a law that put very onerous burdens on the post office to prepay their employee retirement health benefits 50 years into the future. So the post office is the only federal agency, and no private corporation is required to have these kinds of reserves. It's essentially making the post office begin to set aside reserves for employees that it will hire in the future that haven't even been born yet, which is ludicrous as you think about it. And this has been the cause for the billion-dollar losses that your listeners have heard about every quarter, every year, for many years now.
Okay.
But without that requirement, the post office would have made money in 6 out of the last 7 years. And that single requirement is responsible for close to 80% of the losses reported since 2006, so 14 years now. So that could be repealed instantly by Congress, and there's been efforts to try and do that, but it's a partisan issue, and the privatizers don't want to relieve that stress. The more immediate problem, and it is a very real problem, is the problems caused by COVID-19, which has caused mail volumes to collapse. In the first quarter alone, which was really only impacted for a couple weeks by the COVID shutdown, the post office delivered 600 million fewer pieces of mail, and it would have been a billion had not the census forms gone out during that period of time. So that was just 2 weeks. If you think about this current quarter, when it ends in June, it's going to be billions of pieces of mail that aren't delivered, so they're not getting revenue from it. The post office doesn't get a dime from public expenditures, from taxpayers. It's required to make all of its money off of the services it provides, selling stamps and package fees and et cetera. And so they really do need financial relief, just like the airlines have gotten and other vital industries have gotten. And they were set to get $25 billion out of the first CARES Act package that passed in March, the one that sent most Americans $1,200 checks. But President Trump personally pulled that $25 billion out of that act and instead substituted an offer of a $10 million loan with lots of strings attached that would give the White House power over closing post offices and raising rates and a whole bunch of other things that were kind of a poison pill for postal service managers. It's gone back, and now the House has recently passed their latest stimulus package that has the $25 billion back in it and has mandated that the $10 million loan is still on offer, but the strings attached are no longer be in force. So we're encouraging everyone to contact their legislators and ask them to help advance this bill, the bill that just came out of the House and is waiting action in the Senate. It's obviously a...
This is the HEROES Act you're referring to?
Correct, the HEROES Act, yes. And the Postal Service piece is not the contentious piece in it. There's lots of other things that are the sources of argument, but it's really essential that the post office gets funding because they will run out of money come early fall. No one's exactly sure when, but they're talking about September time frame, and we'll start to see bad things happen well before that September time frame because they just won't have any money, and they'll have to make draconian cuts that will particularly hurt senior citizens and African Americans and immigrants and other small town and rural people who really rely on the post office. And one thing I want to just make your viewers aware of is that, listeners aware of, is that the Postal Service has been a particularly great employer, and it's a major employer of African Americans and provided leadership opportunities for a long time. 28% of the postal workers are African American, about double the national average of population. they make in the low $50,000 a year median pay with great retirement plans. And it's been a real boost for African Americans into the middle class. They've also had leadership positions within the post office, and the post office has, in fact, earlier, I think still certainly earlier in the 70s, was a civil rights institution. Postmasters in L.A. and Chicago and New York were African American. There was a wildcat strike that really set the post office on a different course in 1970, and President Nixon tried to have the military deliver the mail, and it didn't work. So it showed the value and the hard work that postal workers do, and it's not just something that anybody can do. It's a very highest skilled profession.
Right. Well, thank you so much for breaking that down for us. And what you said about race, that actually might be another reason Trump is after the post office. Don't want to be cynical about it. But thank you so much, Scott Clinger, for breaking that down. We're out of time now. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. Our audio engineer is Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Y'all, please stay safe.
I was born by the river, in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? I look around and all I see, masked faces staring at me. Keep your distance, don't touch me. Get your hands off my teepee. Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity? I'm sick and tired of staying at home. Even worse, I live alone. Gotta get out, I need to roam. You can't shake hands on the phone. Touch, I need to feel, I need to hug a friend for real. I'm not down for this new deal. I'm not down for this new deal. The COVID killer keeps piling it on. Counting the dead goes on and on. We gotta stay safe, gotta be strong. Ride this out no matter how long. There's no borders, there's no walls. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Around the world, hear the call. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity?
listening to KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals,